Welcome to Conversations Live. For more than a decade, we've brought you the best in books, entertainment, and current events. When the movers and shakers of the world have something to say to you, they say it to us first. Now, here's your host, Cyrus Webb.
And welcome back, everyone, to Conversations Live. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb. Glad you all could join us once again. Richard Cahan is making his first appearance on our program today to discuss his new book called Un-American. We're going to talk to him not only about what it was like for him to bring these photos to life, but also to be able to tell a story of individuals that maybe we may have seen in photos but have never been able to hear about before. And if you're just hearing about the book, we'll tell you a little bit later how you can get it for yourself. But, Richard, hello to you, and welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Cyrus. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Richard, I think the great thing about this book, and we can kind of begin the conversation here, is that you're able to bring us a great collection of not only photos, but also stories, of course, that a lot of us are just hearing about. I mean, what has it been like for you already to hear the response to the book?
Well, I'm amazed at how people understand the relevance of the book. They see that even though these photos were taken 75 years ago, they see the connection to the times now.
And I think that's the interesting thing here, because the connection to the times, I think it's so fascinating in being able to read about these families and these individuals. And I think, Richard, when I was going through the book myself and I was prepping for the segment initially, I thought, you know, these are people that we could see anywhere. I mean, is that one of the eerie things for you when you were compiling these photos from these different photographers about how these are people that today in 2016 we could see anywhere in the country?
Oh, absolutely. That was one of the things that struck us. When we talk about the incarceration of Japanese Americans from 75 years ago, we tend to think that they were kind of an insular group that kept to themselves and were separated from kind of middle-class mainstream America. And what these pictures show really is that they lived in really nice neighborhoods. They wore blue jeans and leather belts, and I know appearances aren't everything in life, but they were very much a part of the American mainstream, and they were just literally picked up, taken away, and forced into camps. They call them camps. I think prisons is a much better word for usually three and a half years.
Yeah, and I think the thing that is, I think, so sad about this, and I'm a fairly optimistic individual, Richard, is that, you know, this was done basically because of how they looked and how they were seen. And I think, you know, that is, I think, the parallel that is so powerful today, because unfortunately, even though there's been so much progress that's happened in this country and even around the world, that there are still individuals who use things like that to be able to separate us and to try to make it an us against them. I mean, was that one of the reasons why you wanted to make sure that Un-American was something that individuals would be able to see and to read and to be able to really be able to be a part of?
Yeah, I wanted people to first relate to the Japanese Americans who were picked up. 70,000 of them were citizens of the United States like you and me, and I wanted them to be able to see their faces and to see their trauma and their, you know, we have pictures of the tags that they wore on the day that they were picked up, and we have pictures of the last games that they played before leaving. We wanted to show how we all relate to it, and I think ultimately as you look through what I think is really kind of a beautiful but heartbreaking collection of photographs, I think you think to yourself, how would I respond if something like that happened? Would I help? Would I write a letter to the editor? Would I, you know, take care of the belongings of my neighbor if they were being taken away, which might involve taking care of their farm for 3 years? So this wasn't something that was easy to do sometimes, you know. And I kept thinking as I went through the book, what would I do if I was in that situation?
Right, and I think that is the question that so many people will be able to ask. Now, Richard, one of the things that I did not know about you when I first booked this conversation, but then once I was reading Un-American, and then, of course, doing my prep work, I saw that you have been able to be a part of a lot of other great books through the work you've been able to do through City Files Press. Talk to us about the mission of City Files, because, yeah, I mean, even when I was noticing when I was on the website, that it seems as though what City Files has been able to do is to share stories, again, as I mentioned earlier, that maybe some of us have not heard about but can definitely relate to. Can you kind of give us the backstory?
Yeah, City Files Press is a tiny publishing company comprised mostly of my colleague Michael Williams and myself, and we started about 13 years ago. And we are picture editors and journalists who believe that we try to find collections of pictures that tell a story, and then we try to understand what these pictures mean. My colleague always says, well, what does it mean? What is this? You know, there's one thing to show a portfolio of pictures, but it's another thing to try to figure out what a group of photographs means. So we do books always related to photography. We actually published a book last year that we're very proud of. It was a look at Chicago blues clubs in the 1970s. It was taken by Michael Abramson. But what made that book, the book's called Gotta Go, Gotta Flow, what made that book so special was that a slam poet champion by the name of Patricia Smith took all of these 80 pictures and she wrote poetry to them, and she kind of got in the minds of the people in the pictures. So it's not enough just to, people come to us all the time and say, oh, they have a great collection of pictures, but it's more important to us to figure out what they mean. We've done two books on the photographer Vivian Meyer, who I think a lot of your listeners will be aware of. She was the Chicago nanny who died in 2009, and she's now considered one of the great photographers of the 20th century. And we figured out and wrote about her life story. I've actually written, I'm embarrassed to say, three books about a Chicago architectural photographer by the name of Richard Nickel. And what attracts me to him is he had a tremendous passion in life to save architecture. He was really one of the first preservationists in the country, and then he died in the demolition of the building in the 1970s, and he left behind a great collection of photographs and writings, and that's what we've done there. So we're very lucky. We move to what we think is important.
Right, and then you're able to share it with us, and then, of course, you'll be able to widen, I think, our understanding, I think, of these times as well, and we're going to talk more about that. For those who are just tuning in, either on the radio side or online, you're listening to Conversations Live. We're excited to welcome Richard Cahan to our program today. He, along with Michael Williams, have put together a fascinating book called Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II, and it's a collection of not only great photographs by photographers like Dorita Lange, but also, of course, great interviews as well. I want to talk about one of the photos by, is it pronounced Dorothea or Dorita?
Dorothea Lange.
Yeah, one of the great photos by Dorothea is on page 160 of the book, and there you have something that I think, again, our listeners in the South will really appreciate. You have these children that are being taught here under a shade of a building. You know, I want to talk about photos like that and the stories that, like what Dorothea were able to share. Richard, I mean, how did that strike you that here they were in these situations and still, as in, you know, of course, you know, we've all heard the stories about slavery here in the States and the things that happened there and, the struggle to be educated. What was it like for you to see something like that happening with these children?
Yeah, I think people have to realize that the Japanese Americans that were picked up had no idea whether they were going to be away from their homes for a day, a week, a month, or forever. And this is a picture of kind of an informal school class at one of the camps very early on. And what people realized very soon was that life was going to continue. They were going to be in these camps probably, well, for the duration or longer of the war, and who knew how long the war would last. And so makeshift schools started in the summer of 1942, just a couple of weeks after they were taken from their homes. And eventually real schools began, and they were run in the camps, but it was very important to these people that education didn't suffer, that this was a very important part of life and culture.
Yeah, I think that is the thing. And I think, you know, there is such a thing to think about this happening to children, again, not understanding, again, what is happening, and then being put in that situation. Another great photo by Charles Mace, that's in the book, is on page 178, another one that captured my attention. And I was really drawn, even though I don't have children of my own, Richard, I was really drawn to the children because I always think about, over the years, how impressionable children are, and in working with them, and how things like this, they linger with them, you know, and it stays with them and mars them. I mean, what was it like for you? I mean, as you were able to think about the impact on, of course, all of those who were taken to these, you know, to these prisons or to these camps, but especially what it did to the children.
Well, many of the people that are still alive, the people that I talked to that were subjects of these photographs, were children at the time. And I was both amazed at their kind of naivete, their innocence at all this. They told me that in some ways this was an adventure for them. They got to, this sounds funny, but they got to sleep in horse barns because that's where their families were kept the first couple of nights or the first couple of weeks. They took trains. They saw snow for the first time. They left California for the first time. And their parents were, you know, very much available to them during this time. But if you talk to them about how it affected their family as a whole, it was devastating. There's no question about it. The lack of privacy. These were army barracks with open walls, and so there was very little privacy for families, and there was no partitions in bathrooms at first, and so people had to go to stalls. Women had to go to stalls right next to other women. It was very, very hard, especially on these people. And there was giant mess halls where they ate, and oftentimes kids ate with other families, and families did disintegrate during this time. Health care was, I think, at a minimum. These barracks had usually one light bulb. They were shoddily constructed. They were oftentimes in deserts. Wind would blow through the windows and the cracks of the walls, and it would be very cold. So they have both a kind of adventurous, naive look and a very realistic look. And I think as they got older, many of them realized how difficult it was for their families.
I think the other thing is, and there's another powerful picture I want to be able to just bring attention to our audience and for those who haven't gotten the book yet, to definitely take a look at. It's found on pages 118 and 119. And one of the things that was recorded there by one of the parents, Richard, of one of the children that was there, said, "I never dreamed I would see my children behind barbed wire." And it really goes again to, as you were saying, you know, in being able to hear from some of these children, you know, as adults about the experience. And what it, you know, what they were able to take away from it. What was your hope when you finished compiling these photos and these interviews? What was your hope that the reader would be able to take away not only from the experience but also from the recollection of these individuals?
Well, I think that photographs are very special in their way of bringing us back to a time and a place. And this photo that you mentioned on page 118 is amazing. It's a long line of Japanese Americans, and they've just stepped off a train. There's a train in the background, and they're greeted by soldiers in kind of doughboy hats. These were, you know, this is World War II, but somehow the guards had still, you know, World War I uniforms, and they each have a rifle by their side, and they're facing off with these people who have arrived with their suitcases and their children. They look dazed and confused. They can't imagine that, you know, here they thought that they were being loyal to America by registering, by reporting, and they arrive at a temporary camp. It was actually the Santa Anita Racetrack in Los Angeles, and here they're greeted by, oh, it looks like between a dozen and two dozen soldiers, and they all look very serious. So all of a sudden, they know that they are considered the enemy.
Right. And that goes to another thing as well, Richard, you know, the questionnaire. And I think,
right,
you know, it's just, again, you think about this happening. And again, unfortunately, how some would say that there are parallels even today as to having their loyalty to, you know, to the country that they live, you know, being questioned. You know, on pages 174 and 175 on the one photo, there is the gentleman there, Captain William Fairchild, addressing these inmates. And with the questionnaire, one of the questions that sparked a lot of outrage was, will you swear unqualified allegiance to the United States and forswear allegiance to the Japanese imperial? And one of the comments that was made there, some felt as though it was inappropriate for U.S. citizens to even be asked a question like that. I mean, so, you know, when you were able to reflect on that and think about, you know, we all have heard that saying, Richard, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I mean, do you hope that that's also one of the things that people think about the dangers of questioning who people are and also where their loyalty lies?
I do. I mean, imagine for a moment if 2 years after you were taken from your home, you're asked to sign basically a loyalty oath that you're loyal to the United States. Now, first off, you're a citizen, so you think it's inappropriate. And secondly, you do start to have some doubts about this country that is taking you away from your home. And I do think that there are parallels to this question of having Muslims register in the United States now. This is how the incarceration began. People were asked to register, and a few days later they were picked up and taken away. And it's when we start separating American citizens and saying, you're an American citizen, but you don't have the same rights as the other American citizen. And we're going to take you away without a trial, without charges. We're not going to tell you where we're going to take you away, but it's for your safety, so they're told, and for the security of the United States. That's a very serious time, and we're getting close to that time. One thing that this book really taught me, and I think most people understand it, that hysteria and fears really cause us as individuals, as Americans, and as just human beings to make irrational and unfounded decisions. And that's what worries me. You know, this didn't happen, you know, a couple hundred years ago. Most of the people, or many of the people in these photographs, are still alive. So, yes, times have changed greatly since the 1940s. But when fear happens, strange occurrences begin.
If you don't mind, give us a timeline, Richard. We talked about earlier about some of the other books that CityFile Press has done. What is the timeline from when the idea for this was birthed to the actual finishing of the interviews and compiling the photographs? Can you give us an idea of that?
Sure. This was one of the fastest books we ever did. We started in late 2015, and it took us about a year to put together. The photographs were easy. The photographs are at the National Archives, which is the government repository of photographs and texts that are produced by the government. And most of the photographs here were taken by government-paid photographers. So they were all there. But what wasn't there was the personal stories behind each photograph. And we made a list of 30 people who were subjects, you know, individual subjects of the pictures, and we found almost all of them. And when we didn't find people, we went to the local communities and found the local newspapers from the days that they were picked up, or the camp newspapers, to really tell the story through these 140 pictures. I think it's pretty complete. It starts with what Japanese neighborhoods look like before the pickups began, and then it very carefully looks at the days, the preparation and the days of pick up and then take into these early camps, these what we call assembly centers, and then the many later years in the 10 internment camps that were spread all over the country, and they returned back to home in California. So it's a very complete look, and I hope that in these 140 pictures you get a real sense of what it was like. This was a path that America went down, and it's ironic that some people now say that the incarceration is a precedent to the idea of having Muslims register, and what they're forgetting to say, and they would understand it better if they looked at this book, it's a really bad precedent. This was not the road for a republic to take.
Right. I think that is it. And I'm so glad you mentioned that about the photos. One of the things that you all do share in the beginning of the book is that these photographers were asked to come along and to capture this. I mean, who would have known at the time, you know, that these photographs would then be able to help to tell such a powerful story, and really, you know, I think a sad story in many ways as well, because, you know, when you want to think the best of people, you want to think the best of intentions, and then to think about what was done to individuals just because of what they look like and who they were as a group of people, you know, it really does say a lot, you know, about us and the work that is yet to be done, I think, and that is the big thing. Have you found that I am curious about this, Richard, and then we're going to let our audience know how they can get the book. Have you found that generationally the book has been received differently, or have you found that across the board there's been a general consensus of appreciation for the book?
There has been a general consensus of appreciation. I get lots of notes and letters from people who have bought the book, and they've given them to people who lived through the incarceration. And many of them have said that it helps them understand many facets of it. Obviously, 140 pictures doesn't tell the whole story, and there is no way to tell the whole story. But it gives them a chance to really see what not only the, what they went through, but what many, many people went through. So I've had a great response to this. People see how relevant it is, and they're, I think they're taken by the artistic beauty of these photographs, and they're lulled into, you know, when you get to read about every photograph and see exactly what happened and see the photograph in context, that really helps very much.
Right.
You know,
the other
I think
thing
it could
is
be
that I'm sorry.
Oh,
no,
I'm
sorry. Go ahead,
some
Richard.
Ways it could be, in some ways, it can be classified as an art book or a photography book, but the truth is there's an awful lot of history kind of snuck in there.
Right. I wanted to talk about the privilege as someone who enjoys a great conversation like the one that I'm having with you. What was it like for you to have their trust to be able to share part of their story, Richard?
Well, I was amazed at how open people were. I had heard that many Japanese Americans, like Holocaust survivors, you know, don't share the story with their families and have been pretty silent about it because obviously they've gone through a great trauma and in some ways they spend the rest of their life processing this. But to the person, everybody was, well, one person didn't want to talk about it, but 24 of the 25 people that we talked to were very open. And I think that in some ways now they're all, you know, this happened 75 years ago, so most of the people I talked to were pretty much between the ages of 80 and 90. I guess there I talked to a woman who was 98.
Wow.
And I think that they realize that they have a special responsibility to share this with people who are interested. Interestingly, several people asked me when they heard my name was Richard Cahan, they asked me, you know, that why I was interested in this story. I think they thought that only Japanese Americans are interested in this story. And I said, no, this is a story of America. I think any America would be interested in it. And frankly, I think any human being would be interested in this story.
Right. Well, I'm definitely interested, and I'm so glad that I had a chance to be able to speak with you about it, Richard. Again, everyone, Richard Cahan has been our guest for this segment. Great conversation with you, Richard, and so sorry about losing you there. Thankfully, for because of technology, our online audience, you guys won't know a thing by the time many of you hear this because my team would have edited it, so you never would have known that I lost Richard there. But
everybody
but
needs
again,
an
the
editor.
Book, exactly. The book is called Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II, again, by Richard Cahan and Michael Williams. I also mentioned, of course, the other work that Michael's been able to do. So make sure you all go to the website at www.cityfilespress.com. www.cityfilespress.com, and that will give you more information not only about this book but also some of the other great books that have gotten some great reviews from different individuals. So make sure you guys go over there to find out more information about the book. And Richard, also noticed that you guys are on social media as well. They can actually stay connected with you that way as well.
Yes, they can. The best way, really the best way is I have a Facebook site. It's my name, Richard Cahan, C-A-H-A-N. I don't have enough friends, and I'd love people to friend me.
All right. So we will make sure that we do just that. And Richard, again, congratulations to you and the team at City
Thank
Files
you,
Press, and looking forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be the last interview of the year. I hope everyone has a very happy New Year.
Well, thank you. Same to you, Richard, for sure. And we thank your audience for tuning in to another great segment of Conversations Live. If you all came in late, you missed part of the conversation with Richard, don't worry. Thanks to our online friends, you all can catch the replay right after we go off the air. The link is already available through our social media site. So head over to facebook.com/CyrusWeb or go over to twitter.com/CyrusWeb. You can click on the link there, listen to the show completely for free, and share it with your friends from there. Until next time, I'm your host, Cyrus Webb, saying, as always, enjoy your day, enjoy your life, enjoy your world. Make sure you take out time to enjoy some good music as well as a great book. Thank you all for choosing Conversations Live. You all make it a great one.